of stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Good evening. This is your host, Rock Cash, on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 805-399-1000, entering in the access code 769608 pound when prompted. If you have a computer or a smartphone, you can go to bbsradio.com and navigate to station 2, then click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests, toll-free USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Tonight, our guest is Adam Kogesh. Adam is a Iraq war veteran who turned activist for peace. Since then, he's been taking on the man in a lot of different ways, educating the public on a YouTube channel, Adam versus the Man. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on this evening.
Lots of questions for you tonight, and people are very optimistic in what you have to say. But can we start with you giving us a brief summary on your military history, such as your MOS and your duties while you were in Iraq?
Sure. Well, I was one of those strange cases that really enjoyed boot camp. I loved the challenge because the reason I joined was, you know, I wanted to put my life on the line for something that I believed in, and I thought that gave me a great sense of purpose in my military career, brief as it was. And I really joined because I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. And I felt like I got that out of it, but I had the naive belief that the Marine Corps had a net effect of peace on the world, if more by its presence than its actions. At least that's what I would say. And I enlisted when I was 17 in the delayed entry program. I tried to go to boot camp a year early and couldn't quite pull it off. But I went to boot camp right after high school, deferred college for a year in order to go through recruit training at MCRD San Diego, Marine combat training at Camp Pendleton, and field artillery school in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and then checked in a reserve unit in Pico Rivera while going to college in Claremont in Southern California. And I volunteered to go to Iraq in February of 2004 with the Civil Affairs team. I was on a very small six-man team. I taught myself Arabic. I got promoted to sergeant while I was in country, which was pretty cool to get a field promotion like that. And I enjoyed the challenge, as traumatizing as the whole experience was. And I was actually in a weird kind of position because they really do flip a switch in you or at some point really promote the kind of thinking where the ultimate good you can do is to die for your country, not to live for it, not to fight for it, but to die for it. And your success is measured in sacrifice, not in productivity, because you're only in the statist paradigm, the belief that disputes should be settled by force and violence, or that is an appropriate way for the world to be organized. Is, you know, is that an acceptable premise to someone's service in the military? And I wanted to go back to Iraq. I was in Fallujah from February to December 2004. It was a very enlightening experience. And I wanted to go back because I didn't get a Purple Heart the first time. And I got in trouble for having brought a pistol back. So I spent a year at Camp Pendleton mowing lawns and managing a barracks as a sergeant who spoke Arabic. With civil affairs experience, he was willing to go back to Iraq. And as a result, when I got out, was just disgruntled enough to really start questioning things. And that's what got me going. And I really got my start politically right after that with Iraq Veterans Against the War.
You said civil affairs. Was that like a psychological operations unit? Or what was your job consistent of in Iraq? Were you actually in combat situations, or were you in psychological operations situations?
Well, that's not really an either-or question, but there is an important distinction. What we were doing was not PSYOPs. There were PSYOPs operating in the area. There are much fewer of them. There are a lot more civil affairs guys. At least there were at the time when civil affairs was supposed to be the tip of the spear, and that was the big disappointment of my deployment, that instead of being the tip of the spear, we were more of a fig leaf for the occupation. But PSYOPs guys were doing they called them the sneaker monkeys, and they would, you know, when we were in a siege of Fallujah in 2004, they were the ones distributing materials and with giant speaker arrays on the tops of Humvees, blasting messages about leaving the city and curfew and things like that. And you know how glorious the American occupation is for the great Republic of Iraq. And the civil affairs guys, like myself, by contrast, now, like what I mean by not either or, is a lot of those PSYOPs guys were legitimately in combat and really engaged at the ground level. Their sort of combat was, direct combat experience was more kind of incidental, similar to ours, but they were definitely, involved in combat operations, as were we in civil affairs. And I was attached to my company, or my six-man team was attached to my company, 2-1, which was responsible for Golf Company 2-1, which was responsible for the blockade positions on the western side of the city of Fallujah during the siege in April of 2004. So we were involved in that. We were right there and we were present the whole time. But what we were doing was much more on the level of shaking hands, kissing babies, and trying to be the liaison between the military and the local civilian populations as much as possible. So we really thought that was the mission in Iraq, right? That everything was about relating to civilians. But one of my disappointments was to see that as an occupation, it was still being conducted in a way where the infantry units were first and foremost occupiers of specific territory, and it was broken down into areas of responsibility. And if anything, civil affairs was kind of an adjunct to that infantry mission.
What turned you around?
Well, it wasn't so much that something turned me around, other than my experience made it impossible to deny what I already knew. And I was actually against the war before the war. I went to a day of student walkouts in February 2003 when I was in college and undergrad at Claremont McKenna. And I didn't think it was going to be worth it. I called myself a libertarian at the time, but I didn't really know what that meant, that I didn't understand the beauty and the universality of the principles behind what it meant to be or what it means to be libertarian. So I was against the war more as a pragmatist than as a matter of principle, and therefore I was able to be made a sucker in that I was against the invasion, but I was pro-occupation. I made the excuse that, I just wanted to help clean up our mess. But really, I was just young and an eager Marine who didn't want to miss the party.
And in your opinion, Adam, what do you think that the war in Afghanistan was it about? Was it about the resources and the opium? Because I hear all kinds of stories of troops just guarding opium fields and making sure that the crops are flourishing for the legal drug pushers. Well, they call themselves legal, but it's all illegal. Did you see any of that while you were there?
Well, one of the common pitfalls of the conspiracy analysis of war is that it's tempting to attribute the cause to a single interest. In this case, the drug industry or the government's beneficiaries of the drug industry or the prison industrial complex, or them working together around a single dynamic. And remember, I was in Iraq, not Afghanistan, so I can't really speak to that. But in terms of the analysis of war that makes sense to me from my experience and just from my observation of history unfolding in front of us and, the little part that I participated in, war is a very complex government racket. And when it can happen, when the racket succeeds, if you will, it's not because a few people got together and said, hey, let's have a war and let's get rich doing X, Y, and Z. Of course, that might be part of it. That might be one event. That might be the initiation of it. But it's happened, and it's possible because all of the forces that are required to get behind a war have conspired and added up to someone being able to make that decision and press that button as commander-in-chief and say, we're going to start a war, or we're going to deploy troops, or we're going to keep troops deployed, or we're going to invade another country, or whatever form that takes. And sometimes it really is that simple. But in modern war, it's a lot more complex than that. And these are all factors, and not just the drugs, but not just the direct military spending of the military-industrial complex. Like, the military-industrial complex could not have done it alone. They could not have done it with the oil industry and with all of the various interests of government that do have a part to play in this and will profit either in power or in money from any of these particular wars. So I think the conspiracy approach to war is very important in understanding it, but it's also important that we don't get carried away trying to assign an overly simplified narrative.
Well, it wasn't so much the conspiracy. It was so much the blatant lies of the administration as you watch them through the years and them stating, well, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. And then all of a sudden, the push to war, Saddam Hussein was the bad guy and he can strike us at any imperative moment and we need to do something about it. And it's... he's an intimate threat, which was none of it was true. And
well, I think that is a conspiracy. I mean, I'm using the term more broadly that just because that's out in common knowledge and people do it openly doesn't mean it's not people conspiring who know that they're going to be screwing over other people. I think the one of the elements of the conspiracy I would describe what creates war. Not so much as a singular conspiracy in the way it's normally thought of, but rather a conspiring of factors. But those individual factors have real conspiracies coming together. Like for those in the Bush administration said, well, if we put together this kind of propaganda effort, can we get away with the war? And they actually conspired to create an environment that would make the American people just supportive enough that the troops would go, okay, aye, sir, we're going to get on the plane. We're going to march in. We're going to start pointing our guns at people. We're going to start killing people. And that there's just enough buy-in from the American people, not just because of the propaganda effort, but because of all of the various interests who contributed to that, so that whatever dissent there was rendered less relevant. Remember, the high point for the anti-war movement was before the war started. You know, globally speaking, the greatest outrage to the war in Iraq was shown before the invasion. After that, it really kind of petered out, which is kind of sad, but it also says something about the modern institutionalized, industrialized, large-scale version of what is the racket of war as carried out by the United States government.
Well, and now you're fighting the man pretty much in a... in a manner of civil disobedience, and what got you prompted to go at all of this in this direction, to where you went into Washington D.C. and you loaded a shotgun and you cocked it. That was a dangerous move. I'm surprised that you didn't, they didn't shoot you. You didn't get shot. What kept them from shooting you? In your perspective,
only because I would be tempted to get into the specifics of that, and there's still some outstanding liabilities. I'd rather not discuss those details. But there's certainly it's a great question, and perhaps one day I'll be capable of speaking more freely about that. But as long as you're going to go back to the beginning, so to speak, of my full time endeavors as an activist, I'd like to share a little bit about how I changed, because it was really important for me, like that I went from a point of, well, I'm a libertarian because I don't want to be a Republican or a Democrat, to really understanding what that means and where I am today. And it was a very humbling experience for me now in retrospect to take 10 years or so to go from, well, I'm a libertarian, so there, to, wow, this is the destiny of the species, to achieve a voluntary, harmonious society based on respect for individual human beings, based on the non-aggression principle, based on self-ownership, based on I'm not a slave, I own myself, and so do you, and all of the beautiful principles behind that. So I was involved in the anti-war movement as one of the few representatives of libertarianism, if you will, and I wanted to be one of the best representatives that I could be in the anti-war movement. And I had a real opportunity to reach out to a lot of liberals, to reach out to a lot of conservatives who were anti-war at the time, and show that there is a unifying philosophy that brings it together. Or in other words, as a libertarian, I knew I was right about everything. I just had to prove it to everybody, right? So I had to, I wanted the airtight arguments. I really wanted it to be indisputable. I didn't want to come down to arguing politics like so many conversations did with all the various liberals that I was surrounded with as a matter of preference. As anybody who understands libertarian philosophy would know, you know, arguing one liberal philosophy or one liberal policy versus another is really a matter of, you know, how can we point guns at people to result in a better outcome for society? And you go, well, wait a second, maybe we don't point the guns at anybody. And I wanted to be able to connect that to every issue and to every policy. And that's what motivated me. And I remember building an economic framework that was reflective of that philosophy based on the capitalist ideal of absolute harmony, remembering that the ultimate means of production of capital is not a corporation or a factory, but the individual human being. So there was a moment during the bailouts in late 2008 when that was being covered under Bush. And I remember I was sitting at a group home that I created for Iraq veterans in D.C. where we did PTSD support groups in the basement once a week. And I was sitting in the living room watching TV, and it all just sort of snapped into place on economics. And I had this framework. And I feel like overall that was a very small part of what was a 10-year process for me. And at the end of that, or at least where I would say I got to where I am now in my worldview, it's been to the point where you see, at least I have come to believe in the value of the insights of my experience and of my analysis. And to me, this is about how the philosophy of liberty can serve to make the world a better place. And when you really see the value in that, and you're as fortunate as I am to also see a way with my life to serve that, it's really hard to get interested in anything else. And that's what's been motivating me.
Okay, let's focus back on what prompted the wars, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, 9/11. What is your opinion on the theory or the conspiracy theory, or what did you think of the entire matter of 9/11, and how did you see it?
Well, for a long time, I really tried to avoid the analysis of the event itself and just stuck to the sort of agnostic line about it, which is, well, what matters is that we've been manipulated. But I think it's a lot more important to see that there is some fundamental manipulation of what happened that day. And I think the best we can do when so much information is being withheld is theorize. And it's not a matter of was it a conspiracy or not, it's a matter of which conspiracy and what extent. And in that sense, we might never know what exactly happened, but we do know that there's enough fishy statements, there's enough contradicting information, there's enough specific interests that were apparent in how things were handled that day and in all the aftermath, that you know there was, to a certain extent, some form of an inside job, to use the most controversial, I think, simplification of that. And we really owe it to ourselves to be aware, because it's more likely, historically speaking, if you really look at the record of governments, that the United States government or corrupted elements of it would promote something like that happening than not, because it's happened before. And the worst example, of course, would be the burning of the Reichstag. And to take it back to Hitler is to really, you know, oversimplify and dramatize it. But this is the place where that's the best parallel. And you go, well, what else could what else could governments do? What else are they capable of? And when you just stop and think, well, what is war? Systematic destruction of human bodies by machinery for political purposes? Like, holy crap. And war, you come to think of that term as a euphemism. Is it really that much of a surprise that a government that would be willing to kill for money, for power, would also lie and fabricate an excuse to convince you that it's okay for them to be lying and killing for money and power? Of course not. So I think taking that broader view of 9/11 at this point is you know how we take it as a valuable lesson and move forward with it. But I've definitely the more I've looked at over the years, the more I've come to be convinced that there were to a certain extent elements of an inside job. But you know, it's also one of those issues where there's so much infiltration of the 9/11 truth movement, at least online. So many trolls, so many people with false leads and people who want to ridicule the movement. And it is such a complex topic, and it is such a great heist, if you will, that it really is one of those maddening things. And you can get lost and go down the rabbit hole on 9/11 and a whole host of other various specific government conspiracies. But I think the most important thing is to focus on understanding the racket of government so we can move past it. For some people, it's talking about 9/11, and a lot of people have done a lot of great work with that issue, and I definitely support it.
Oh, well, with that being said, since you went to that point of all the people that are out there on the net, one of our listeners asked, this is Alex in Ohio, and they want to know, Adam, what is your opinion on shock jock radio host Alex Jones? Is he legitimate? Is he a legitimate force?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Alex Jones has done more for the cause of liberty than anyone in his generation. And the effect of that is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the Alex Jones effect is immeasurable. And, I can only hope to someday with my own operation live up to the standard that he has set and the level of impact that he has had. Now, does he sensationalize things? Sure. Of course, anybody. I mean, so do I. Anybody who's trying to evoke an emotional response is going to have some element of that. There's some places that, he deserves legitimate criticism. And anybody who's gotten as big as he is going to have detractors and is going to have screwed up in things along the way. And I know I've made a lot of mistakes that make it easy to understand things that I've seen Alex Jones criticized for, but he is really just such an incredible force. You have to wonder, anybody attacking Alex Jones must be it must be some kind of plant or troll, because there and it's funny because people will raise that possibility about Alex Jones. Like Alex Jones could be, a detractor from the movement or a plant. And sure, there's plenty of manipulation of the independent media by outside forces. And who knows who's infiltrated Alex Jones's organization, who's tried to influence him one way or another. But there's no way. I mean, it defeats one of the very easy ways of defeating an implausible conspiracy theory is the plausibility analysis. Would it really make sense for the government to subvert the liberty movement by creating Alex Jones as an incredible host who's going to build a huge audience, who's going to wake tons of people up, and then what? Lead them astray? Like, it doesn't make sense, because the people that have been empowered by Alex Jones will not be led astray, because they are what is most important. Important among those of us who are getting more engaged and are seeing these bigger picture issues and getting involved in the evolution towards a free society, and that is that they think for themselves. And it's insane it really is. I shouldn't say insane, but it is absurd to propose that Alex Jones is a plant or some kind of subversive of the movement in any way, if only because of his incredible record of having done so much good and waking people up. And I would hope that people could be dismissive of the various claims against me for the same reason, that I've got 2,600 videos on YouTube and have been podcasting for years and involved as an activist for years more than that. And I think, that just kind of flies in the face of those who like to take pot shots at people who are actually out there doing stuff.
I have one more question before we go to break. Frank in Delaware wants to know, Adam, did they teach you about Major General Smedley D. Butler and his role in the business plot to overthrow FDR while you were in a boot camp Marines?
Jeez. What do you think? You know, I love talking about Leslie Butler because it's such an important story. And I remember when I was in boot camp, they taught me about Smedley Butler. And they taught me that he was one of the most decorated Marines in military history and two medals of honor and all the banana wars and yada, yada, yada. And they didn't once mention the fact that he came home and was an anti-war activist and wrote a book called War is a Racket, in which he described himself as a high-class muscle man for big business. No, they conveniently left that part out of your boot camp education. And when I got out and realized that and you know, did that research myself, it was like, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me. Did they really think they can get away with anything? Well, yeah, when they can isolate you. And, you know, I've studied the story of the, you know, the coup that Butler was invited to lead on behalf of various business interests and all his various other exploits. But it also, you know, gave me a very important insight to the use of the military by government, is that they can really only get away with so much. And part of it's been dependent on being able to isolate the military population, in a way, isolate the law enforcement population from the rest of society or from the people they're oppressing, you know, the dehumanization of the enemy. And when I was in Iraq at the Chow Hall, I remember when they switched the TVs over to Armed Forces Network, and I even was joking back then, all propaganda all the time. You know, worse than Fox News. So they are only now losing their grip on how much they're able to isolate people because of communications technology, because of the internet, because of smartphones. And I think all of that is conspiring to make it that much harder to start a war, or to perpetuate war, or to convince anyone under any circumstances to do violence on behalf of the state. And, you know, that's, to me, that's a very encouraging dynamic.
Awesome. We'll be right back with Adam Kokesh on the BBS Radio Network and The People Speak. Adam, we'll be right back.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBS
Radio.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Welcome
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back. This is Rock Cash, your host on The People Speak on the BBS Radio Network with our guest, Adam Kokesh. Adam, welcome back. The question we have for you, Adam, right now is everybody wants to know about your journalistic endeavor and your YouTube channel called AdamVersusTheMan.com.
Well, I'm really just so fortunate to have fallen over backwards into this role. But if you're asking me how it happened, I can't offer an explanation as much as just tell the story.
Okay. Well, one of our questions from a listener by the name of Marcy, she wants to know if you enjoyed working on RT Radio and why did you leave them?
Well, it was RT Television.
Sorry.
The glory months of Adam Versus the Man on cable television. And I got an offer to reach a larger audience and have the production support that RT afforded. And I really loved it, but it was really stressful and it was really restrictive. I don't think I would want to do that full time. And I got canceled for political reasons by the network. So at the time I wanted to stay, I would have at least wanted to finish out my 1 year contract and do another 8 months there. But that wasn't an option. So I decided to go independent and do my thing online. And I learned a lot from the experience. I got a lot of exposure to, you know, the production aspect of television. I think that experience is what made me a producer, not just a host, not just a voice, not just the guy who can ramble on and on for hours and hours without even thinking about it, but you know, someone who can really combine resources to create the maximum experience possible for the audience. And that's what I've been doing for the last, 2 years now, minus the last 4 months in jail. But since I went independent, I've, you know, grown my YouTube channel from about 25,000 subscribers now to about 90,000 subscribers. And before I got arrested, I was doing 1.5 million views per month, which is, enough to found a business on. I don't know if I would call it journalism. It's funny. I kind of struggle with that word because I've always thought that journalism was used to describe making propaganda credible or the art of making propaganda credible. And
isn't that a fact?
And some people use the term journalism in a very noble sense. But to me, it's all just relaying information. If anything, I do more work, and at least with my podcast, it's more about reading the headlines and the mainstream stories and giving the counter narrative or the proper narrative or showing how it's propaganda, as well as bringing, you know, doing my own journalism, you could say, in the presentation of a complete body of information 5 days a week with my podcast. And I'm really looking forward to getting back to that. And I do have to say, in case I don't get a chance to say this later, to everybody who's listening, who supported me while I was in jail the last few months, who donated to my legal defense fund, who supported me every step of the way, who wrote me letters in jail, thank you, thank you, thank you so much. It's because of you that I'm in a position to be doing what I'm doing right now. And right now I'm writing a manifesto, my book, that should be the a really good outreach tool for people to introduce them to the philosophy of liberty. I think it's going to be a valuable outreach tool. But also, I look forward to getting my production started as soon as possible once my legal issues are cleared up. And there's still a lot to be done there. But AdamVersusTheMan.com is back within our control entirely. And now that I'm out, and anybody that wants to contribute, you can donate at AdamVersusTheMan.com/invest. We greatly, greatly appreciate it. I still have some legal issues I got to deal with. I still got a lot of stuff I'm working on. Hopefully, I'll have this book ready to release, and it'll be available for free online before I would go back to jail, if that's what has to happen. But it's all possible because people are willing to donate every single day to support Adam versus the Man. And we especially enthusiastically accept Bitcoin donations.
Now,
Litecoin,
RT News, were they somewhat restrictive on what you can and can't say? How far of a limit or how far of a stretch were you able to go before they tried to restrict you from saying it, whatever it was that you needed to say?
There were no restrictions really in editorial content whatsoever while I was at RT. And they really were true to that. We only had one disagreement the entire time that I was at RT in terms of content. And it was because when I interviewed Ron Paul, I wanted his title on the lower third of the screen to say future president of the United States of America. And they said, no, you can't do that because you're using the RT formatted titling. And, you know, if it's something somebody who's not serious, you can put whatever you want. And I used to have fun with those and give people kind of wacky titles sometimes. But that was really the only disagreement we had. And it was explicitly in my contract, and it was the only way I would take the position, that I had complete editorial control of the show. And they really did respect that. And I made a point to do a couple stories that were critical of Putin. But, you know, I knew that the understanding from the perspective of the Russians, you know, same as it has been from, I should say, the Russian government, from the American government, every time the American government sponsored media overseas, is they want to provide an alternative narrative. And they want to generally provide something that's counter to the narrative of the competing protection racket, that is the host government. And their purpose for hiring me was because my message delivered that, not because I was critical of government globally or Putin specifically. But, you know, I did a couple stories that were critical of Putin, and I did them, you know, carefully but deliberately, as I would have, you know, whether or not I was on a Russian-sponsored network, as exactly I thought they were relevant to an American audience. And there was right. No problem with that. But I did get canceled right before the big midterm elections that were so fishy. So who knows?
Yeah, there was a few things that I was watching in videos last night of you, and there was a lot of things that popped up, one of them saying that you're a Russian paid agent. And I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of things that are going to be put out there to discredit either you or Alex Jones or Jesse Ventura or a majority of these people that, you know, are dedicated to the Constitution, keeping our Constitution intact. I have a question from the audience.
Is if you want to use the terms paid Russian agent, yes, absolutely. For a brief period as a TV producer, I was a paid Russian agent in the same sense that, you know, we took help as or the American founders took help from, you know, from the Germans and from the French. Then, right. You know, I mean, it's there's nothing wrong in saying, well,
They took help from the Germans, the French, and borrowed money from King George to fight against them.
Yeah, so I mean, the idea of, well, you're taking foreign support, therefore you're a traitor. Well, in a sense, no. I'm a traitor because I believe our government is corrupt and should be, should be dissolved at this point, the federal government. I'm not a traitor because, you know, I will do whatever it takes within my morals to further the cause of liberty, which is essentially the message of universal morality.
Amen. Clifford in Texas wants to know what you expect or if any major changes in 2014 midterm elections.
Well, they're going to make you think that whatever changes do happen are huge and significant. You know, if there is some tipping of the power in Washington, is it going to be really significant? In a sense, but if you understand government to be a reflection of the paradigm, that is, whatever tolerance the people have for oppression, that's what they'll get, then you understand that they're has, you know, that every election in a sense is a measure of that shift in the paradigm. But there hasn't been a major shift between 2012 and 2014, or there probably won't be. I hope there is. I hope that you know, when I publish my book, it sells out 100 million copies all over the world, and everybody gets a chance to read it, and it radically changes things. But I'm not optimistic that it's going to be on that short a time scale, or that the general trend of people becoming more liberty oriented, the general stress of the liberty movement, I don't think it's going to bear fruit quite as soon as 2014. So there is going to be some tumultuous, you know, changing of power in Washington in 2014. But in the long run, is it going to be significant? Is it going to be seen as a turning point? Probably not. I am interested very much to see what happens around Obamacare and what factor that is, because that does have a very immediate practical relevance. But in terms of, like, are we going to have a more or less war-prone state? Are we going to have a more or less police state-supportive Congress? You know, is it still going to serve the special interests and the banking class? Those fundamentals, at least if the 2014 elections were held today, you know, none of those would be altered significantly.
All right. Jason from Ohio wants to know, Edward Snowden, a hero, traitor, or neither, in your opinion?
I think Snowden is absolutely a hero for, you know, doing what he did right. I mean, I don't know if I want to endorse the framework of heroism, because he did what he felt was right, and he was very courageous in doing so. And I guess in that sense, you know, he would be a hero to me, to someone by my values, who values freedom, who values openness in government, who values transparency, who values nonviolence. And, you know, if that makes him a hero, if you share those values, then he's a hero. If you value violence, if you value institutionalized violence in government, if you value the police state, you know, then he's not a hero. So it's, you know, just think about, you know, whether he's a hero or not is dependent on your values. What values did his actions reflect? It took a lot of guts to do what he did, and it was absolutely righteous to expose the criminality of our government. I think it was huge. Like we did recently. 1%, right? 1% of the documents. We got a long ways to go to realize the impact of what he did. It's incredible.
Oh, I agree totally. There is no reason why. The only time a government wants to spy in on you is when they fear you. And if the government is fearing you, then they're going to spy in on you. I've got a caller online, Fred from Wisconsin. Fred, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Adam. I was wondering if you thought Ron Paul failed to uphold his oath of office when he chose not to speak out about appointing Henry Kissinger to lead the 9/11 Commission, or when Max Cleland resigned from the 9/11 Commission, or even on the whole Building 7 thing. Don't you think that's his responsibility as elected official to uphold his oath of office in those situations?
I see how you could interpret it that way. That you would impose a certain standard on any member of Congress. But first of all, you can only do so much. And just because that's what you would do if you were a member of Congress in his shoes, or what you would have liked him to do, doesn't mean that he violated his oath. And I think the one thing about Ron Paul that really is unimpeachable is his legislative integrity, as a member of Congress, and his consistency in upholding his oath. And, you know, I don't think that oath necessarily, you know, requires some specific action or compels that, you know, as you said, to question those particular appointments. But he definitely could have done more on the issue, and he made the choice not to. And for the great impact that he had, I think we got to respect that.
Okay. So, and what's your opinion on Building 7 having a free fall speed like it, falling at free fall acceleration like it did? Is that something you're willing to look over, or is that something you're going to pursue more if you end up running for office?
Well, I don't need to pursue it. I know that Building 7 was taken down by explosives. That's like that's been stated and then retracted. And that doesn't, you know, that's not something that they can say, oh, never mind about that. That just goes away. And I think anybody who's looking at the issue honestly already has acknowledged that there's no more government investigation that's going to change the words that came out of Silverstein's mouth about that. You know, we decided to pull it, right? So, I think it's already there. I don't want to sound negative on this, because I have great respect for the 9/11 truth movement. I consider myself a part of it. But one of the problems with the method of activism that's really taken a hold of it culturally as well. If you don't acknowledge this, if you don't say exactly this, then you're hiding something. Like, I'm not afraid of the issue. I've analyzed it. I know where I stand on the issue. I've pursued it to the extent that I'm willing to. And I generally agree that, with the premises of the 9/11 truth movement, if you can, come up with, if you could put it in such collectivized, generalized terms, that 9/11, was the product of conspiracy. So, and I don't mean, some conspiracy other than the stated government conspiracy of, the attack orchestrated by bin Laden. And you don't have to go, well, would you pursue it more? No, I'm already with you. I'm already in agreement.
I was just wondering, in a democratic society like we have, and with, with what measures are in place to deal with a situation like that? We have the oath of office. We have the media, who's unfortunately looks like taken over by corporations. So if the oath of office doesn't cut it and the elected officials don't do it, or the media, how do you suggest, or how do you think we should be dealing with situations like 9/11 or other false flag events in our society? How can we do it if the oath of office doesn't cut it, the media doesn't cut it, and elected officials don't cut it?
Well, the oath of office will never cut it. The elected officials will never cut it, because government is premised on being a protection racket. So you're not going to get the answers that you seek from that. So I'll answer your question in two ways. And one is to answer, what do you immediately do about this when something like this happens, when a 9/11 happens? And the first thing is to question. And now, like never before, we're able to question because of independent media. So I think it's really important to support independent media outlets like BBS Radio, like AdamVersusTheMan.com, like anybody you think that is bringing a counter narrative that you value, to put your money where your ears are, so to speak, and support all the people that are busting their butts and getting the stuff out. Many, like even for me, I haven't taken an income from what I've been doing in the last year and a half, because I really believe that I'm building something that's of value to people. I hope, and so far people have shown that they value what Adam versus the Man produces too. So that's one element of it. And when it happens, being able to question it means being able to act accordingly, not enthusiastically running and signing up for the military, speaking out. If anything, I think the fallout of Barack Obama's attempted war in Syria was, or rather attempted involvement in the war in Syria, is a reflection of a greater awareness. I don't mean to, toot my own horn here, but the work that the anti-war movement did around Iraq might not have prevented that invasion, but I think it laid the framework for people to question the next one, and that was really important. But in the bigger picture, in the long term, the second way I'm going to answer your questions with the bigger solution, and this is what I think Adam versus the Man, what I bring, what my candidacy brings that is unique in terms of the how we move past these problems, because a lot of libertarian solutions have been, well, we're going to have education and we're going to have activism, and then step two, underpants, step three, free society, and everybody's going like, whoa, wait a second, you got to go back to step two there. You got to really have a how does this happen? And I'm all for agorism as well, not paying taxes when you don't have to, and living off the grid, being self-sustaining, all of these things of conscientious lifestyle, totally support that. When it comes to the how, you can fight issue by issue, you can fight inch by inch, you can fight law by law or election by election, and they'll take a mile behind your back and they'll laugh at you while they're doing it. And the only answer that really overcomes all of these fundamental problems with how people who get this philosophy want to work to achieve a free society is localization. And that's why I'm running for president in 2020 on the platform of an orderly dissolution of the United States federal government. But it's not just about me and that candidacy or this campaign. It's really about the bigger picture of the paradigm shift, and that America has the chance to lead the world again, because we have in this country a unique structure with states where we can return all that power and authority right back to the states without pulling the rug out from underneath anybody, but radically increasing the amount of freedom that we have in society. And by taking the lead on pushing power down locally, we can bring about a global paradigm shift away from modern statism that pushes power down eventually all the way down to the individual. and achieve a truly voluntary stateless society where we don't have to fight issue by issue, but rather when the society's paradigm shifted, that these centralized authorities that would do such things, that would create such false flag attacks, that would start wars for no reason other than to perpetuate their own power and to pay off their sponsors, that is not even possible, because that doesn't exist, because people have risen up and demanded self-governance.
Awesome. I've got another caller on the line, Steve from Australia. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rock the Hunter. It's great to hear you talk, Mr. Kokesh, sir. My question to you is the 84 officers and a dozen or so generals that are being purged from the military, do you think there's anything behind this, that Obama is doing this now for a specific reason?
You know, I'm sorry, I haven't been following the story as closely as I'd like, so I wouldn't try to comment on the specifics of this event. But I mean, the answer is just in any common analysis of the politicization of the upper echelons of the military. And, you know, for a long, long time, you know, you could say really as long as the military has existed, because as long as war has been a racket, which as long as war has existed, the, you know, objective has been to convince people to do things that are against their self-interest, to convince people that they should go and fight and kill and die on behalf of special interests. So the selection of people in the military is not based on performance. It's based on their ability to fit into that racket. And the higher you get, the more you got to toe the political line.
All right.
In your opinion, do you see more and more people waking up from the military, though? Last question.
Yeah, and that was something very encouraging about my experience, is that when people wake up from the military, because it's partly because of direct exposure, but they also get woken up with a much greater acceleration, if you will. There's a greater motivation. I don't like the term waking up, but they become much more deeply aware, and they're able to square it with a much more powerful experience than just the average American.
Great. Jen in Washington, D.C., she wants to know, Adam, will you run for public office, and what do you think about the future of libertarians in political positions?
Well, like I said, I'm running for president in 2020 on the platform of an orderly dissolution of the United States federal government. I think most of the time, if you're fighting for anything less than that, the purpose of fighting inch by inch should not be to win that inch, but to wake people up along the way. And in that sense, I highly encourage anybody who's running on a platform that they believe in to jump in and take advantage at whatever level they're comfortable and work on spreading the message and getting people to care about the issues that they care about. I think that's it's an incredibly worthwhile endeavor. But in the bigger picture, you know, I really think the only change is going to come when it comes from a consensus at the level that is necessary to dismantle modern governments from the top down. I think whatever countries, whatever regions start doing that first are going to be the most prosperous. But they're going to have to do it by, you know, not by just traditional political motivation, but by really embracing the philosophy and embracing localization as an answer. I think, you know, in terms of alleviating the pain of statism, a lot of elected libertarians can do an incredible job, and if only for that, you know, I wholeheartedly support any effort that is going to reduce the amount of violence in society.
Awesome. And Clifford in Texas wants to know what your thoughts are on Jeremy Scahill and how he recently threw Alex Jones under the bus on C-SPAN, calling him a lunatic and a liar.
Well, you know, I met Scahill at an Iraq Veterans Against the War convention, and he's a brilliant man, and he knows his stuff when it comes to his journalism and his research. But when it comes to the bigger picture, I'm afraid that he is of, you know, a different kind of ideology. And I hope to get a chance to interview him someday and really get into with him. I have a lot of respect for what he does. I didn't see what the specific incident you're talking about. Now I feel like I got to go look this one up. I got to go catch this video. I assume it's on YouTube. But honestly, sorry about Jeremy Scahill. Doesn't surprise me.
Awesome. And one other question that I have for you is the media. Well, we know it's bought by the corporation. Why do you think they're going along with it? How come more and more people aren't backing away from it. But now I know, like, Glenn Beck, he was on Fox News and everything. He went separate, but I think he's on a different agenda. I think that, to me, he's a media proxy also. But a lot of disinformation. What do you think on, say, Glenn Beck, for instance?
Well, you know, I really admire Glenn Beck, and I think generally what I said about Alex Jones, you know, applies to a certain extent to Glenn Beck. You know, he has done a lot of great work. He's woken a lot of people up. He's got a lot of people thinking, and I think he's come a long way himself. He has certainly evolved in the last few years. But, I think a lot of people who understand the compromise and the corruption of the mainstream media and its relationship to government really only do so at kind of a cursory level. And it's funny because libertarians go, well, what do I need to know about the media? Do I, as a libertarian news consumer, do I need to know how the military, supplies talking heads and revolving doors and the military influence on Hollywood? Do I need to know the details of this, or do I just need to know that I generally can't trust the media because it, serves the whims of government? And most libertarians, stop their awareness at that level. But if you think about it just a little bit more, the mainstream media outlets are still businesses. And if it wasn't for the audience, it wouldn't exist. It wouldn't happen. And so, yes, there is, I don't mean to deny that there are these problems with the mainstream media. But in the same sense, we as libertarians, as people that want to convince people to improve their lives or to improve the social status of liberty, have to take that same consideration into play here. How do we respect that people simply, they want the easy solution the same way we prove that, right, that we generally do. So right. I think that this is where the liberty movement is going. It's very important to me in relaunching Adam versus the Man to be a lot more true to the values of nonviolent communication and to really make sure that people understand how libertarianism is a positive message about nonviolence and about harmony and moving humanity forward. And it's not that government is bad and evil and wrong, and if you're a statist, you're going to go to hell, but that, hey, look, people, we can do things better if we do them cooperatively. Let's show people a better way. Let's be positive and show how living by these values improves our lives, because that's how we're going to get people to want to join us.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. We'd like to have you back again, Adam. This has been a wonderful interview. I'd like to thank you for joining us this evening. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I'd like to remind our audience to join us next week on the People Speak Radio on the BBS Radio Network. Our guest will be Will Thomas, 9/11 Chemtrails, Smarter Meter Research, and activist and author. Join us next week on the People Speak. Adam, thank you once again, and have a good evening, sir.
My pleasure.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief of us, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.